Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please, make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, Democrats unveiled articles of impeachment against the President of the United States. Here's House Judiciary Chair Jerry Nadler.
Today, in service to our duty to the Constitution and to our country, the House Committee on the Judiciary is introducing two articles of impeachment, charging the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, with committing high crimes and misdemeanors.
The two articles are abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Let's bring in NPR senior political editor, correspondent Domenico Montanaro. And Domenico, there's been such a divide, there's been such a toxic atmosphere for so long. You know, it just may feel like a day like any other day, but it's really not. Can you briefly break down further what's in these articles?
Yeah, I mean, the two major pieces to this, as you noted, are abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Notably left out was any mention of a quid pro quo or the word bribery, which we've been litigating for about a month now. But it does note that Trump conditioned a White House meeting and military aid, quote, for corrupt purposes in pursuit of personal political benefit. Also left out of here was there was no obstruction of justice charge, which had just come up in the House Judiciary Committee meeting. So that's what's in pretty much and what is left out.
So obstruction of Congress, but no obstruction of justice. And there was a question as whether this would come from the Russia investigation. Mueller saying he couldn't clear the president of obstruction in that investigation, couldn't clear him, but implied it was Congress's job to either, you know, to impeach or charge. Now, was that purely for political reasons? You know, the Russia report was critical of Donald Trump, but was so diminished by his attorney general Barr and by his allies on Fox News that it's been made kind of a caricature.
Well, I think there's been so much time between when the Mueller investigation report came out that, you know, the Democrats didn't act then. They wanted to keep this narrowly focused on Ukraine. This is, after all, what won over moderates to be able to support impeaching and removing the president. So I think you really have the moderates who are pushing things here rather than the progressives who've been kind of pushing for impeachment. Mm-hmm. And I've been seeing a lot of progressives disappointed that they didn't include more things and didn't go further. There was one allusion by my reading of this on page 7 mm-hmm. of the articles to the Mueller report, sort of an abstract reference, and said that these actions were, quote, consistent with President Trump's previous efforts to undermine the United States government investigations into foreign interference in United States elections, and that's it.
Okay. Well, Republicans and even some supporters of Democrats have said they should wait for the 2020 election, let voters decide. Here's the Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff today.
Ben Franklin said, "We have a republic if we can keep it." The president and his men say, "You can't keep it, and Americans should just get over it." Americans don't get to decide American elections anymore, not by themselves, not without foreign help.
There's an echo there of Mick Mulvaney, White House Chief of Staff's words when he said, yeah, there was a quid pro quo, mm-hmm. just get over it. But again, what did they say about not waiting and you know, going to court over these subpoenas that the president is refusing to let witnesses like Mulvaney respond to?
Yeah, there's been a lot of criticism and reaction from conservatives toward House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler for intimating that they can't wait until the 2020 election because the president is a threat to the security of the 2020 election. They sort of were saying, oh, that's hogwash. Well, I would just point to an interview that we did at NPR, Rachel Martin on Morning Edition with Neil Katyal, the attorney who's represented a lot of Democratic causes before the Supreme Court, where he said, quote, the allegations here involve cheating in next year's election. So it's a little weird to say, let's have the election and then let that decide. He then he said that was kind of like being accused of cheating in Monopoly. And your solution is, let's just play a game of Monopoly and see who wins to decide who's right. That can't possibly be the rule.
I just want to take a second to listen to the president's ally, the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, today criticizing the Democrats.
No, it is not difficult to defend this president because this president did nothing that's impeachable. It's hard to defend Democrats on how they're running this House and what they're doing inside their majority. That's the difficulty that I have.
We're going to hear that back and forth, I'm imagining, for the foreseeable future. So I'm sure we'll have you back, Domenico.
Yeah, and unquestionably Republicans rallying around the president.
Yeah. NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, joining us now for more reaction to today's top story is Representative Ben Klein, Republican of Virginia. He's a member of the House Judiciary Committee. Congressman Klein, you've called the impeachment inquiry a farce and a tragedy. Your reaction to the specific charges made in these articles of impeachment unveiled today?
Well, it is clear that the Democrats are bound and determined to impeach this president and remove him from office. They have been set on that course ever since he was elected. 3 years ago. I would argue that they have set the bar so low for impeachment that just about any presidential activity is going to be falling under this category that they've set and called abuse of power.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Let's take each article in turn. First, Democrats argue the president abused the power of his office by withholding military aid to pressure the president of Ukraine into investigating the Bidens, as well as unfounded theories about Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election, as we know. What exactly do you dispute about these specific events?
Well, there are four facts that haven't changed since the beginning of all this and won't change. Both President Trump and President Zelensky say there was no pressure. The call transcript shows no conditionality between aid and an investigation.
But that's an argument that is actually at the heart of all of this, whether or not it actually shows that. I mean, Democrats say this is a definite violation of the Constitution to pressure Ukraine to help in the 2020 election.
In fact, to the contrary, the Constitution gives the president the right to set foreign policy. That very power is what gives him the right to pursue corruption in Ukraine, and he can't exempt a potential political rival or his son or anybody from that investigation.
But the argument is that the investigation was looking into a political rival for personal gain.
If we were to try and say, go pursue corruption in Ukraine and go try and investigate corruption in Ukraine, but exempt a political supporter, that would be obviously wrong. So exempting a political opponent would also be wrong. Exempting his son would also be wrong. So when you go and investigate corruption in Ukraine, you can't say except for these people.
Okay, if that's the argument, let's talk about the second article of impeachment, which deals with the obstruction of Congress. Democrats say the White House has urged witnesses not to cooperate with the inquiry and to divide subpoenas. In fact, the White House blocked witnesses from testifying. The Intelligence Committee has documented 12 current and former officials with direct knowledge of the events. 10 have been subpoenaed and have been blocked from testifying. Not a single document the committee has requested has been given. Let's talk a little bit about what exactly do you dispute here?
Well, we can talk about the right of the president to exercise executive privilege, his claim to executive privilege. If some have contended that it is too broad, they can go to court. They have. The courts have come back, and the president has used the courts just like any other American under the 14th Amendment. You have a right to due process. So the president is pursuing using that right. And arguably, the Democrats are the ones abusing their power by saying, we're not going to wait for the courts. We're going to charge you with obstruction. In the meantime, That is an abuse of power.
Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff today addressed the argument that Democrats should just wait for the election next year, which has also been a big argument, instead of impeaching President Trump. Let's listen.
The argument, why don't you just wait, amounts to this. Why don't you just let him cheat in one more election? Why not let him cheat just one more time? Why not let him have foreign help just one more time? That is what that argument amounts to.
Congressman, what's your reaction to that? Do you think there's any risk to the integrity of the next election if the president faces no consequences here?
Well, I'm pleased that Chairman Schiff appeared from his bunker today, because I sat through 10 hours of testimony yesterday in the Judiciary Committee about his report. And for him to be the leader of this impeachment process just puts a fine point on the fact that it is a fraud and is not in any way a legitimate impeachment inquiry.
You know, Congressman Klein, I'm thinking about the public at large. They're listening to us. They're looking at all of these hearings. They're trying to make sense of everything. Do you feel it is your constitutional duty to serve as a check on the executive branch? Partisan politics aside, do you worry that not holding President Trump accountable, you're eroding the power of Congress?
Absolutely not. We have a responsibility to the Constitution and the rule of law. You do have an abuse of power. It's in Congress. It's with this majority who will not abide by the voters' decision back in 2016 and have been on a course to remove him ever since. It's disgraceful, deplorable. And I think that Nancy Pelosi needs to respect the will of the voters and withdraw this impeachment process.
Representative Ben Klein, Republican of Virginia. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What were the best albums, songs, and memorable moments from 2019? I'm Robin Hilton. Join NPR Music all this month as we look back at the past year. From Lil Nas X and Billie Eilish to Lizzo and Leonard Cohen. Listen on All Songs Considered from NPR with new episodes each week.
It's here and now.
So every glacier is a huge amount of moving heights with always going forwards into the valley.
That was Linda, our guide on a trek up the Sólheimajökull Glacier in Iceland. We'd driven miles through land rimmed by snow-covered mountains and fields strewn with volcanic rock, steam here and there rising from Iceland's geothermal underbelly, to report on the climate crisis, because Iceland is on the front lines. In the Atlantic, the UK on one side, Greenland on the other, the North Pole above, a popular stopover for tourists, many of whom come to see the glaciers, an irony because all 300 of them are melting, one, the auk, actually disappeared, and with our travel emissions, we're adding to the problem. We stand by a gray lake on a black beach of broken volcanic rock in freezing, pelting sleet. In the distance, the only color, the glimmering green-white ice of the glacier. Linda explains it used to reach where we stood.
How much has it receded?
A lot. So in the last 50 years, it retreated more than 17,800 meters.
Oh, wow. Well,
yeah, a lot.
That's about 8 football fields. We've got crampons, ice picks, harnesses. As we hike over to, then up the ice, what seemed like a good idea is now terrifying. Ice, wet from pelting sleet. What could go wrong? Crevasses.
And the most important thing to know about crevasses is that they can form in a few hours.
Trying not to fall in, we are up and humbled. As they say, when an ice piece breaks off, you're breathing the same air the Vikings did. And like Iceland, glaciers are otherworldly. No wonder Tolkien based his Middle Earth and Lord of the Rings on this land. But they are also fragile. When we leave, Linda tells us to look back.
My advice is to take a mental picture of Sólheimajökull. Because maybe next time, if you will be back, it will be disappeared or completely different from now. So watch it and keep in mind how it is now, because everything changes every day.
Our glaciers are melting away, but most of them are retreating.
That's one of Iceland's progressive new young leaders in his modern government office in the capital Reykjavik. All this week, we're going to look at the impact of climate change on Iceland's natural resources. A harbor closed because of rising land, others impacted by rising seas. Let's start there.
Yeah, my name is Guðmundur Ingi Guðbrandsson, and I'm the Minister for the Environment and Natural Resources in Iceland. Just call me Mimi.
Minister Mimi?
Yeah, that sounds really good.
Okay, that's what I'll do. Well, a receding or melting glacier adds to sea rise, but what does it do for the country when you don't have the glaciers there?
Well, there are several issues. One is the change in the runoff from the glaciers. Some of the glacial rivers that we have, we use as a means of producing electricity. Or most of them, they flow freely to the ocean. And the impact on the ecosystems of the oceans are not known enough.
What is in those glaciers that's going in the ocean, and how will that impact your oceans? Do I understand as well that in one town it's twisting the water pipes or the infrastructure underneath a town?
The land is rising because the glaciers are melting, because then you have less mass on the land, so it simply lifts up.
So the land is rising where the glaciers are melting because the glaciers are so profoundly heavy, they were holding the land down.
Yeah, and within some of the glaciers there are volcanoes, and as the weight of the ice becomes less, the probability of an eruption increases. It sounds like a lie, you know, it's like, what? You know? Personally, some people are simply brought up next to a glacier that they have in their perhaps 50 to 60 years lifespan, seen retreating. I was raised up on a farm where my grandma taught me the names of the mountains, and there were four glaciers that we saw on the horizon, and one of them was Ok. Now we see three glaciers, and probably if things continue, a second one will have disappeared. So it's also very iconic and symbolic for many Icelanders, the way they mentally affect us. And I'm not sure if we fully understand those social and emotional changes that are related to that.
What else do you do as the Minister of the Environment to offset climate change?
We have already been quite successful when it comes to heating. Almost 100% of heating in Iceland is from renewable resources, geothermal and hydro. Then we also need to look at fisheries and agriculture and tourism. In 2000, we had about 300,000 people visiting us, a similar number to the number of the whole population in Iceland. In 2010, it was 500,000, and now it's about 2 million people coming here. So we haven't perhaps been able to fully manage tourism in Iceland.
But they're trying. This is the magnificent Strokkr Geyser. It's packed with tourists sent here by online travel sites. Iceland's officials are trying to spread the tourism around. Still, we find travelers like Wendy Tim of Rochester, Minnesota, who want to help.
It's a tough situation, but I think, you know, tourism can help in a way.
Somebody suggested that every tourist should pay for a tree to be planted.
Yes, exactly. That's
you do that?
Idea. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. How about carbon tax on your flight?
Fine. No problem. Yeah.
At the sleek visitor center, we meet the Robinson family from Plano, Texas, traveling with their adult son.
That's why we're here. We wanted them to see the glaciers, and we wanted them to see the icebergs and the geysers, because who knows if his kids will.
That's kind of sad. As I wander over to son, do you think about that?
Yeah, especially within my generation, being green and lessening our carbon footprint is a very big thing to us. I mean, it'd be beautiful for us to be able to maintain it for the generations beyond me.
We are in the early stages of having tourism as a major industry.
Hi. Meet Skarphedin Steinarsson, Director General of the Iceland Tourist Board. He tells us there are many reasons for Iceland's popularity. Iceland Air has long promoted the country as a stopover, but for a while recently would even assign you an employee as a weekend guide, competing with WOW Airlines, which expanded too fast and went under. And when a spectacular volcano blew in 2010, the world's attention was on Iceland and people liked what they saw. But also after the bank collapse in 2008, Iceland was cheap. Not anymore, by the way. Well, now Icelanders are trying to manage the crowd. Signs everywhere ask tourists to be safe. Don't climb fences to take selfies. People have died. Don't step on hot springs. The nearest hospital is an hour away.
Also, many of these sites are sensitive and are not prepared to get all the visits that this is bringing. Also, we need to find out how to handle visitors from countries that we've not been having previously.
Like who?
Asians, also North America.
Do you mean not prepared clothing-wise for going out to a glacier or standing out in frigid weather to see the northern lights?
Yes, there are a lot of people that haven't experienced darkness, driving conditions, snow, rain, wind.
Driving out of town northeast, just stunning. No shoulders, nowhere to go.
Yes.
There's no AAA if your car gets in trouble. There may be nobody as far as the eye can see for miles all around you.
Yeah. Even there are visitors here that have never experienced being totally alone. Also, what, you know, nature is very sensitive in springtime. It becomes muddy and it is damaged. You know, we have unspoiled nature here, which is what our visitors want to experience. But we have to make sure that it's not damaged.
You're also conscious of trying to protect the visitors, too. Some of these sites are otherworldly, but they're dangerous.
They are, and it's really heartbreaking. It's not only heights, but when people are walking on beaches and they don't understand how dangerous the ocean can be, when the waves come and just take people away. Yep.
This is also part of the appeal of Iceland. It hasn't been tamed. What impact has climate change had on tourism?
This is probably the biggest challenge for tourism. We are an island. People come here with airplanes. What we need is to find out some way that we can handle this, because traveling and visiting other people and enjoying to meet other peoples and get to know other cultures and other countries is the best way to keep a peaceful world.
Would you ever put a limit on how many tourists can come?
This is one of the questions that will need to be answered one day. Hopefully not.
We've met people who have come to Iceland specifically because they fear some of the awesome nature is disappearing. That's very sad.
It is very sad. And we have to turn that around. It's strange to be a destination where people come to experience this.
Experience you before you're gone.
Yes.
Which brings us back to Iceland's melting glaciers.
The most famous lullaby in Iceland is Sofðu unga ástin mín út í regni grætur.
That's cultural icon Andre Magnusson. You'll hear from him again. But today, his thoughts on that lullaby.
It's very gloomy and it has glaciers in it. It's so sleep, my little love. The rain is crying outside. And in the glaciers, the death deep crevices are howling. Suddenly something so forceful that of looking at it in awe as a godly, dangerous being into being something that is dying. And actually a dying glacier is a rather sad sight. It's like a stranded whale. And it's almost like telling you something. Something went wrong.
This week, we're covering the climate crisis in Iceland. For incredible pictures, go to hereandnow.org. Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
The CEO of the popular luggage brand Away is stepping down after an investigation from the website The Verge detailed a toxic work culture inside the company. Zoe Schiffer is the reporter who broke that story, and she joins us now. Hi, Zoe.
Hi.
So if you travel, you've likely seen folks wheeling around these carry-on suitcases. I actually have one. But for those who are not familiar, tell us what Away does and how they got so popular.
Yeah, it's a good question, because what they do is sell luggage. But if you look at the mission statement and the website, they really position themselves as a travel and lifestyle brand. You're kind of buying into this idea of what your life could be like. They're in the Warby Parker brand of companies that sell directly to consumers and pour a lot of money into Facebook advertising.
Yeah, and Warby Parker being the eyewear company that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you spoke to current and former employees at Away who described this toxic work culture at the company. They complained about working long hours with no overtime, being asked to cancel their vacations. Some even reported being chewed out by the CEO on a public Slack channel. What else did they tell you?
Yeah, so in retail, it's typical to work really, really long hours. And that was part of it. People really felt like they were being pushed to the breaking point. They were working 15 and 16 hour days without a break. They would kind of work towards their one day off in months and then suddenly at the last minute be told, oh, wait, you can't have that day off. You have to keep working. But the really different thing about Away is that it was all taking place on these public Slack channels. Employees weren't really allowed to email each other directly. So they used this often.
Wait. So you're saying that every form of communication had to be on a public channel where everyone could see, including the CEO.
Yeah, exactly. And they really prided themselves on giving really harsh feedback. They would say, you know, don't go easy on the people who work under you. People have to be able to learn. Everything is a learning opportunity. And so while they would talk this talk of you are allowed to make mistakes, it's okay to slip up now and then, when it happened, in reality, it would kind of turn feedback into a spectator sport. There was one line in the article where they said you would hear the CEO typing and you knew something bad was going to happen. People would hear that sound of her fingers on the keyboard and the whole office would tense up just waiting to see who was going to get eviscerated, because it wasn't just one message. It was message after message after message of one person just getting totally chewed out.
So the departing CEO, Steph Corey, apologized for her behavior after your story came out. And she also asked employees not to share, like, or favorite the investigation, even on their personal social media accounts. As we mentioned, she's stepping down as CEO, but she will continue as executive chairman. So I'm just wondering, how significant is this move really? And do you expect it to change the toxic work culture there?
It's an open question for sure. I mean, her apology was one thing, and I think that it was commendable. Not everyone apologizes even after a big investigation like this. Of course, her stepping down is a massive move forward for the company. It's symbolically very important that people are saying, you know, this type of behavior is not tolerable. But I think employees are saying they are hesitant to celebrate quite yet. They're waiting to see what actually changes on the inside. You know, they're bringing in this new CEO who previously was the COO of Lululemon, and that place had its own toxic work culture issues. And so I think that the company has a long way to go to prove to employees that they're actually going to treat them with respect.
That's Zoe Schiffer, writer for The Verge. Zoe, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
House Democrats today unveiling two articles of impeachment against President Trump, charging the president with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, saying President Trump pressured the president of Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden, a political rival in the 2020 election, and then keeping lawmakers from speaking to key members of his administration despite subpoenas. Here's the Democrat Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee.
The president's oath of office appears to mean very little to him. But the articles put forward today will give us a chance to show that we will defend the Constitution and that our oath means something to us.
Well, the White House released a statement calling this a pathetic attempt to overthrow the Trump administration and said that President Trump expects to be fully exonerated in the Senate because, the statement says, he did nothing wrong. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and we often come to him at moments like this. So, Julian, start with, what kind of moment is this? You know, everything has seemed so partisan and so toxic. There's a generation that might remember the last impeachment vote and trial. That was for Bill Clinton, maybe thinking, well, this is modern politics. How would you describe this moment?
Well, look, we've had a lot of moments of toxicity since 2017 and a lot of things that the president have done that were unprecedented. But impeachment has only happened a few times, and this is the fourth case that we can talk about with the president, and that gives it historic weight in a way that some of the other events don't. And it looks like the House will probably pass articles of impeachment, and that's a permanent mark for this presidency.
And when you say fourth time, we have Johnson, who was impeached, Nixon, who left office when a group of senators, as you pointed out, walked across the, you know, to his Oval Office and said, you have to get out, you're going to get impeached, meaning we're going to vote for impeachment articles, you're going to be charged before it goes to the Senate for a trial. So he left before that could happen. And then, of course, you have Bill Clinton and now Donald Trump. So, I mean, how is this resonating with you?
Well, it is kind of watching the sorts of events I write about in the past, and so when you see it happen, it has a different flavor than when you read about it in the archives or you observe it as a historian. And also, it is in many ways a culmination of these tensions that have been brewing between the parties, and then the tensions that have been mounting over this particular president and the way he uses presidential power. And this is the first time we're really going to have, other than the 2018 midterm election, some formal response to what he has done.
Yeah, but what do you think of what the Republicans are saying, which is, yes, this is a culmination. This is Democrats just not liking this president, not liking the fact that he won, trying everything in their power to undermine his presidency, and including the Russian investigation. They will put that in there. And the president said that he feels the Senate will, clear him. Is he right in a way? Because, yes, the House is likely to charge him, impeach him. It goes to the Senate, which is Republican-led. They will probably not find him guilty, probably not remove him from office. Is the president then right in saying that he's going to get exonerated?
Well, in the first part, I don't think he was right in that what drove this was simply hatred for the president. I think the leadership of the House really didn't want to do this. Speaker Pelosi is someone who really was impacted by the 1990s and the Clinton impeachment and was very fearful of going this route. So I don't think in the end that's why they went through with this part of the process. And the Senate probably will not remove him. But what will happen is the House will now have formally given its verdict on what the president did, which matters. It matters in the history books. And equally, Republicans will be on record in the Senate and in the House as saying this is okay. And that's something that will come back in future elections and in the history books.
Take us back. 1868, President Andrew Johnson impeached. He'd succeeded President Lincoln after Lincoln was assassinated. And the House impeached Johnson because he was fighting Reconstruction in the South after the Civil War. So just briefly more about that.
That's exactly right. He had immense tensions with the Republicans in Congress who were trying to pursue a bold program of social justice after the end of the Civil War. And they were really frustrated and angry with the way Johnson was rolling back these efforts. Ultimately, though, they impeached him on a very technical violation of a new law that prevented presidents from removing certain officials who had been appointed by previous presidents without Senate approval. In the end, he survived.
Acquitted by one vote. Yeah.
Exactly. But notably, we talk about the impeachment when we talk about Johnson, and we talk about the different problems that emerged with his presidency. And so that was our first case.
Yeah. Well, he stayed in office. And mm-hmm. So just quickly, did that have an effect on the balance of power going forward?
It did. From the history that we have, he really was much more restrained after that happened and wasn't able to exert presidential power with the same kind of force as before.
So we go to 1974, and as we said, the House Judiciary Committee approved three articles of impeachment against President Richard Nixon. Republicans march up and say, you got to get out. But this was in connection with the 1972 break-in at the Democratic headquarters at the Watergate office building, a comedy. It would be funny if not so sad. But then there was a cover-up, and that's where we get the line that we tell our children. It's the cover-up, not the crime. There was lying about it. Charges similar, obstruction of justice, abuse of power, contempt of Congress. But, you know, I just want to, in the case of Richard Nixon, there were a lot of people supporting Nixon until there was a moment when tapes came out. And it's interesting because we have a president now who says the kinds of things that people say on tapes that are secret. He says it right out loud, you know, uses foul language, has said, I want the president of Ukraine, you know, yelled that at reporters at by the helicopter. I want the president of Ukraine to investigate this. It's almost like what could people be shocked by to shock them into changing their stance on a President Trump?
It's hard to know. And that's a fundamental difference with the Watergate process, in that there were various moments like the revelation of a smoking gun tape, or even before that, the transcripts of tapes where the president cursed a lot. That was actually something that caused outrage in the country. We are far beyond that. Mm. And that sense of outrage is no longer there. And I think it undercuts efforts to have these impeachments actually happen. And the president does a lot of his dirtiest business right in the open. And in some ways, there might be a strategy there that it undercuts efforts to shock the public into responding to what he is doing. Interestingly, with Nixon, the obstruction of Congress was a much bigger issue. In the end, this really moved a lot of Republicans to say this is wrong, that he has to follow through with the process. Whereas today, you know, Republicans basically have said it's okay for him to obstruct everything.
Well, and okay for a lot of things. We're remembering with Bill Clinton. It started as an investigation by Ken Starr into the suicide of Vince Foster. There were conspiracy theories launched by the Wall Street Journal and others, opinion pages and others, that the Clintons had something to do with their friend's suicide. It moved into an investigation of Clinton finances and didn't find anything there and ended up with a blue dress and an abuse of power in the Oval Office, relations between Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. It's amazing the turns that took.
It's kind of unbelievable. The substance was much less serious in terms of the ultimate action compared to what we're talking about today vis-a-vis how you use presidential power. But you look at the quotes from Republicans at the time, especially on the importance of truth and the importance of law and order, and that's not what the Republican Party is about right now. And you can see a pretty profound change in the GOP.
Well, you know, because we know that the president paid through his then lawyer, Michael Cohen, paid off women that he had relations with, you know, claimed on tape, you know, things that he did with women. The notion that if he were to have some relations in the Oval Office, one doesn't see that even coming close to an impeachable offense in this climate.
No, not at all. That's kind of the least of the things that probably a president could do at this point and get away with it. President Trump has gone much bolder. He's just been very open and obstructing. And even in what he did with Ukraine, although sometimes there's denial, there's often admission and the statement, let's do more of it or it's totally fine. And so I think the standards are changing. That's part of the story of this impeachment in terms of what a president can do.
And Julian, you're reminding us, President Clinton was also acquitted in the Senate. No American president has ever been removed by impeachment. Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We shift our attention to Madrid, where COP25, the UN Climate Change Conference, is in its second week. Activists have taken to the streets there, frustrated by what many say is a lack of urgency to stop the rising sea levels and greenhouse emissions. Climate activist Greta Thunberg joined thousands of protesters, many of them young people and from indigenous communities. Joining me now from Madrid is Lyndall Rowlands, an advisor to the UN and author of a recent report on climate change for the international nonprofit group Civicus. Lyndall, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So you're in Madrid. What are you seeing and what's the energy around the conference? Activists have complained that it seems like more is happening on the street and in press conferences than perhaps behind closed doors.
Yeah, absolutely. This is really very much what we're seeing here in Madrid this year. We've seen so much energy on the streets this year. We've seen millions of young people marching in every single country around the world. In Madrid last Friday, we saw 500,000 young people marching. But there just really remains this big gap between what young people are asking for on the streets and what is on the table at the negotiations here at the UN COP.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about your report, which was published this past November, and it focuses on the current challenges the people who speak out for climate justice face. Your report has found that environmental activism is one of the most deadly and dangerous forms of activism globally. Why is this the case?
Well, unfortunately, what we see is very much the people who are protecting our collective rights to fresh drinking water, to clean air to breathe. They're often really on the front lines, and they are, and often these are indigenous people, for example, protecting the Amazon rainforest. And these people, unfortunately, are often being arrested. They're being subjected to disinformation campaigns. And also, unfortunately, in some cases, they're also subjected to violence, including death. Even just last week, we saw that two indigenous people involved in environmental activism were killed in Brazil.
Yes, you've mentioned the Global South and Brazil, and we're seeing that environmental defenders, as you mentioned, are discredited and harmed. What are some of the other ways that you're seeing that happen? It's also happening in places like the United States and Australia.
Absolutely. So I'm from Australia, and I was so sad to wake up this morning to see that, you know, Sydney is completely covered in smoke from the bushfires. It's so sad to see that, you know, school children that were being told a couple of months ago by the Prime Minister that they shouldn't be participating in climate strikes because they should be in school, today they can't actually go to school because the smoke is so dangerous that they have to stay inside. The people who are supposed to be our leaders, our prime ministers and presidents, they're really trying to shift the blame. I think that in Brazil, as I've mentioned a couple of times, we've seen, for example, that these disinformation campaigns, we've seen Bolsonaro there, you know, accusing volunteer firefighters of deliberately starting fires to get attention. At the same time, even in Australia, we saw a top political aide making these same accusations with absolutely no evidence. So I really think that, as the kids are saying in the streets, it's time to really invite these activists into the room and to create a much more just and ambitious environment for negotiations at the UN as well.
Lyndall, I'm thinking, though, too, that the power dynamic here, though, is so stark. You're talking about indigenous folks, you're talking about young people, and if they are being, in many ways, discredited or their lives are in danger, how do you even begin to take on this issue and build momentum for real change?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good question. I think that really we are seeing, you know, young people who are being asked to take on this responsibility. And I personally find them so, so inspiring and so courageous. For example, such as, you know, there are young people here, for example, who've been striking in Russia where when there were these massive climate strikes back in September all around the world, they also wanted to have a group strike there, but they were denied a permit. So they went out and they held their strike one person at a time because they were only allowed to strike one person at a time without having a permit. So they are so courageous. They are risking being arrested. But they shouldn't have to be because really, you know, we should be the adults in the room and we need to be taking on the responsibility. And young people shouldn't have to be fighting for their future and definitely shouldn't be facing the risks of being arrested for exercising their rights to freedom of peaceful assembly and association.
What do you see as the next steps after this conference and this conversation around climate change, especially when it comes to these activists?
Some of the youth activists are exploring options such as court cases and more, I guess, shifting the conversation more towards accountabilities. But there needs to be a lot of progress made in that people need to inform themselves about what's happening, and that when you do inform yourself, you do realize that this really is the issue that is going to affect us all.
Lyndall Rowlands, an advisor to the UN and co-author of the latest Civicus report, We Will Not Be Silenced, Climate Activist from the Front Lines to the UN. Lyndall, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.